All right. It wouldn't be a conference on disinformation in the year 2019 if we didn't have a session on deepfakes. Deepfakes, as a topic, they're everywhere. They might be, this entire production might be a deepfake. This is a kind of the next conversation that we're having, and as of right now, there aren't a huge amount of sober, fact-based conversations, presentations on deepfakes. But there are a lot of kind of bombastic conversations, a lot of tweets, this might be a deepfake, that might be a deepfake, this might be a deepfake, a lot of congressional testimonies at this point. But what we wanted to do is have a sober conversation on what it is, the technology behind it, where it's at, whether it is a real threat, right-size that threat. And we couldn't think of a better person to do that than our friend, Sam Gregory, who runs the Witness Program. Please help me welcome to the stage, Sam.
Hi, everyone. I'm pretty darn sure you're not all deepfakes. You can be reassured. And we're not surrounded by deepfakes. That's the reality right now. But I want to talk about why we have an opportunity to prepare for deepfakes at this point, and what we could do smartly to prepare for them that builds on the experience of you guys, a community of people who thought for a decade now about how we confront misinformation and disinformation and verify the truth. So, I work for Witness. The foundation of the work we do is help many people around the world create trustworthy information that serves as human rights evidence. We do that by training and skills, and we engage the platforms about that. And I'll be talking later about what I view as the positive side of our work. But we can't avoid what we've seen over the last decade, which is how people manipulate video and audio and share it in ways that attack the basis of truth. Attack human rights investigations, attack OSINT investigations, attack our shared public discourse. And so for the past 18 months, I've been focused on the emerging threat of deepfakes, because I think we have an opportunity to prepare better for this than we've dealt with previous waves of misinformation. But I do it from the point of view of knowing what we're dealing with now. I'm not doing this in the abstract. We're thinking about it very grounded in the realities of human rights defenders and journalists and the misinformation and disinformation we grapple with right now. So over the past 18 months, we've done a series of expert meetings, threat modeling, reviews of the technology, meetings with journalists, connecting journalists and deepfakes researchers to really understand what's happening. And I've just tweeted out some links to some of that research so you can access it easily. And I'm going to talk about three things today. One is where we're at on the technology. How has it evolved? How rapidly is it evolving? What can you do with it? Second thing I'm going to talk about are threats. What are the threats that are identified by your peers when they look at those technologies? So not threats in the abstract, not the list of 100 things that could go wrong potentially, but what people say, I'm worried about this because I understand that technology connected to threats I'm worried about now or I think will emerge in the next few years. And what we can do now. What are the solutions as a community here, particularly in OSINT, a community that's fighting disinformation, to prepare better? So first, the technologies. I think of them in these four ways. First is the ability to alter video, just like with photos. So Photoshop for video. Second is to create a realistic voice or face of a human that never existed. The third is to simulate and manipulate a representation of a real person's face, voice, body, or movement. And then the fourth is to remember these are all in interplay with other trends in AI. So effective computing, the ability to micro-target, all the trends that Samantha talked about this morning in the computational propaganda discussion exacerbate the possibilities of deepfakes and synthetic media. And the word synthetic media is used to describe this broader range of manipulations that are possible. So, first question, how many police officers in this video? Quick answers. Two, chat it out. Three, anyone, any raise on three? Okay, five over there, that's very optimistic. There's actually four. There's a fourth one who's just at the front there behind the car. Pretty much no one in the room spotted that. This took about 10 minutes for the New York Times visual investigations team to pull that police officer out. And I'm showing you this on a big screen, right? And pretty much no one spotted that police officer pulled out. Now, this was done with a very simple commercial tool that is now available. That is Adobe Content Aware Fill on video. You can do this right now. You can remove objects in video like you can in photos. Next thing you can do now is you can change the weather in a scene. This is what you can do with NVIDIA AI. Think about the potential for messing with some of the signals we use in OSINT investigations. Third thing you can do now, you can create realistic faces. There's a site called thispersondoesnotexist.com. Realistic hamburgers, realistic Airbnbs, realistic cats. All of these are realistic faces of people, cats that never existed. And this is progressing very fast. So this is the progression in image generation over the past 4 years, from kind of blurry, not very realistic, looks like a 1930s photo, to I wouldn't know, that's not my next door neighbor. Another possibility, you can use real people as puppets by manipulating their facial expressions. This is something that came out in the last month. From 16 selfie frames, you're able to manipulate the face of someone looking like they're moving their head around. You can also do that with the Mona Lisa, which is cute, but you can obviously think about the negative implications of being able to manipulate what someone says or looks like they're saying with their face. The important thing here, the number of images you need to do this has gone down radically and continues to progress. So maybe last year you needed 200 images, they do that with 16 images. So the amount of what we call training data has gone down dramatically, which means many more people are vulnerable. It's not just public figures, could be you or I if you have any kind of Instagram presence. Text-based editing of talking head video. Again, this came out in the last month. The progress on this is very rapid. This is an example of someone manipulating someone and changing what they say based on a piece of written text. So they edited this person to say something that implied that Apple stock had gone down, right? Now this is research, it's not a product yet, but the progress on the research is quite rapid and, to be honest, more rapid than I think many people thought. And you can recreate audio from fairly limited samples. This is an example of a company called Lyrebird. I sound kind of Canadian after I've recorded 10 minutes of training data for this, but if you listen to it on a crackly phone line or you didn't know me well, I have a kind of transatlantic accent, you might believe it's me. It's about 10 minutes of audio. You could create a realistic voice of Sam Gregory. And then real people as puppets. I'm going to show a short video here because this is fun, but I want you to have in mind what you can do when you can manipulate someone's body, how that's used in things like attacks on the basis of, say, drunkenness, or other things like that that can be done when you can imply that someone looks and behaves in a different way than they do. So this person in the middle is not dancing. This is a representation of a real person being driven by the person in the top left. And then finally, deepfakes. And I've come to them last because I think we over-prioritize deepfakes versus the other ways that we can present audio-visual manipulation. So, you know, this is one of my favorites.
I'm asking you all to join me in providing support and guidance to our children so that we can make a real difference.
And this one as well. Okay, so Elon Musk as a baby. Now, both of these are pretty good deepfakes. And it's true still that if you or I tried to make a deepfake quickly, it would look pretty obviously like a deepfake. So I want to be clear when I say now, but it still takes some expertise to do a good deepfake, but it's improving. Now, at this point, you're probably saying, well, that's interesting, okay, cool, cool technology, or terrible technology, depending how you perceive it. But I've got 1,000 problems and deepfakes ain't one of them. Or something like that. You may be less polite. You may be thinking something else, like, where is lunch? Why am I not going to lunch yet? Or you might be thinking something like this. Seriously, my problem is with recycled videos, edited videos. It's not with deepfakes. And I want to recognize both of those problems, because I think about them too. Like, and my colleagues all around the world who work at Witness are pretty much focused on these two. Right? They're like, yeah, I've got a lot of problems now. Deepfakes ain't one of them. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare. Okay. So the rhetoric is extreme, right? So at the moment, we're having a kind of deepfakes in the 2020 election rhetoric moment. We've had the kind of it's a technopocalypse rhetoric moment around deepfakes, right? You can't believe anything you see. And I want to put a little caveat here. Often when we're in the misinformation world, we don't talk about the harms created by deepfakes on the basis of gender-based violence. That is a real problem right now that people are facing, even if we're not dealing with it yet in the misinformation, disinformation space. But keep calm, the sky is not yet falling. Yet. Okay, so what can we do about that? First, let's think about some reasons to take this seriously. The simulation quality is improving, and it's improving rapidly, and the amount of data you need to create deepfakes and synthetic media is going down. Almost all the research I showed you is from the last year, and we just had a wave of papers that came out for the upcoming technical conferences in this area, and it's going fast. Second thing is, how do we receive video? We receive it in a much less mediated way than, say, text or photos, and we have much less understanding of how to mediate it, both to understand our cognitive mediation and learn literacies for it. So we have to be aware of how people are manipulated by video. The third thing is audio is improving rapidly. So the ability to create fake audio is improving rapidly, and the barriers to entry are falling. So that means it's going to mobile. You can go online and do it as a service, right? Deepfakes as a service. And it's being commercialized. And that means the accessibility accelerates massively. When these are open source code or fun academic experiments, they're not all that accessible. When Adobe commercializes a tool, it's massively accessible. When a startup commercializes the tool, it's potentially massively accessible. And it's related to other trends, which we've already talked about, right? Shallow fakes, like other types of manipulated video, the fire hose of falsehood just pumping out content, astroturfing, digital wildfire in messaging apps. So these are all reasons to be concerned. So my argument, and then I'm going to talk about some of the threats we've heard, is we need to de-escalate yet prepare as a community. First reason to de-escalate is our escalation and our rhetoric promotes the very harms we're worried about. Perhaps the greatest harm is everyone's going to say, that's a deep fake when it's not a deep fake, right? You'll be able to say you can't believe anything when you can believe 95% of things you see online. They're just mediated. Maybe they've got a bokeh effect in the background. That doesn't mean you can't believe them. Second thing is we still have time to come up with reasoned, human rights-based responses based in our experience of how to deal with this and how to confront this. And frankly, we can do better than with previous waves of misinformation. And I include in that we, this community, but also the platforms who did not do well in dealing with it, particularly at a global scale. Okay, so I'm not going to do an inventory of lots of threats, but I'm going to share some that we've heard prominently when we've done threat modeling. As examples of places where threats get expanded or altered or enhanced or where it introduces new threats that we haven't anticipated before. So this one comes up a lot in the OSINT community, the ability to introduce subtle edits that mess with the credibility of investigations, of rapid 24-hour news cycles in a way that is hard to detect and we haven't built the expertise yet to do. Another one is this. It expands the safety attacks on journalists and civic activists. We already know this is happening. Some of the most prominent actual deepfake cases were targeted at Rana Ayyub, an Indian journalist, at Iraqi political candidates. And we know from experience working with human rights activists around the world that this is the first thing that happens to someone prominent. I have in the middle here Marielle Franco and the attempts to impugn her integrity by linking her to drug gangs after her assassination last year. We know that it could reinforce existing problems of digital wildfire. We're all familiar with how videos circulate rapidly online, where you receive it in a messaging group, where it's hard to track the context. These tools lend themselves very well for that type of threat. And we know how it can be easily integrated into the types of parastatal and statal campaigns. And I've just put two up here that are very familiar to this community, the Syria hoax type work targeting the White Helmets, and then, of course, from Burma, from Myanmar, the way in which the government itself was complicit in sharing staged images and staged photos of Rohingya supposedly burning their own homes. And it enables the use of credible doppelgangers. And it's been interesting. When we've talked about this with news people, they're actually probably less worried about the senior-level politicians. And I'm not worried about Senator X being deepfaked because all the solutions are being built for senators and congresspeople. I'm worried about local politicians who have tons of media images of them and where the news bubbles up from. So thinking about those as a worry and as a concern is something that comes up consistently with news people. And it deepens and alters news remixing problems. If you talk to mainstream media, they're worried about how their logos are appropriated, how people share content with the BBC logo, or a whatever equivalent logo here, the Al Jazeera logo, in order to imply credibility. Historical figures gone rogue. One of the deepest practices at Witnesses is of archiving. So my colleague Yvonne Eng was like, what do we think about how people would use archives in this context? How would you make President Kennedy say something he definitely didn't say? He was a more optimistic president than many of our current ones. But archives are very vulnerable in the sense that your ability to rebut is limited. And then I want to move to some of the more macro ones that recur. And I think this is clearly one that is on everyone's minds, however much you think about the scale of the threat of deepfakes, which is how they will be used to claim plausible deniability on any image. So in any solution we're proposing, we need to think, how are we going to deal with the fact that people in power are going to say that's a deepfake when it isn't, because that's the easiest out on something that is incriminating or polarizing, or they don't want to be out there. And that relates to how we think about detection tools and how we explain it to the public when we find something. And it reinforces and introduces new forms of astroturfing. So we know how these problems of like fake media presenting an impression that people are mobilized around something that happened in the 2016 US elections, how do we think about that? And it contributes to the problem of floods of falsehood, right? And we've referred to this a number of times over the past day. Samantha raised it in the morning. The idea that, you know, if you can pump out information, I want to emphasize it's cheap to create synthesized information, and it's getting cheaper. So it's not an artisanal question, it could be a volume question. So how do we deal with volume of synthesized information that is attacking the basis of credibility? And of course, not now, but potentially, and that's why I've put not yet, it plays into the kind of micro-targeting that we're hearing about, the ability to create individualized content that targets people with individualized messages that are synthesized with audio and video. Now, I put this up here sort of jokingly, but this is a Russian doll problem and it's embedded in others. So I want you to think about this through your own lens. How do you understand all the tactics that are happening now and where these types of technologies and threats embed in other things? Because they are embedded in a more complex landscape and they exacerbate some dimensions of that. Okay, solutions. And reasons to be concerned about different choices of solutions, right? So what can we do about this? And what would be the implications or the viability of different types of solutions? So some areas to consider. And on our website, we have a list of multiple areas that includes many others as well, but I want to highlight these for this community. Literacies for spotting, the capacity of this community and the journalistic community, tools for detection and who has access to them and who doesn't, tools for authentication and who is excluded from them, and then what do we want from the platforms and from lawmakers? So I get this quite a lot. Literacies for detection, easy, guys, we fixed that. Deepfakes don't blink. Right, so this was a headline from last year in the summer. I know the academic who did the research for it does amazing research, and there was a whole spate of discussion around how deepfakes didn't blink. And people said, okay, we've worked it out, you just look and see if they blink. And just last week, there was a supposed deepfake case in Malaysia, and the sort of prima facie evidence, whether it was or wasn't a deepfake that was being quoted in the media was, we're looking at the blinking, does it work or not? This is not a good approach, because 2 weeks later, the same academic received someone who sent them a deepfake that blinked, and of course now deepfakes blink. Now what I'm pointing to here is the risk of pursuing any algorithm's Achilles heel, right? So this is an evolving process where you are constantly developing new approaches to forgery and new approaches to detection. So the last thing I want you to come away from here is thinking there's an easy literacy we're gonna tell people. Look out for artifacts, see if the teeth are kind of look like they've ground them too much, look out if they've got an odd hairline. None of these are probably good rules in the long run, so we don't want to tell people those. So I'm actually telling some kind of bad news. Literacies for spotting these may not be good, And we've also seen from early research that people don't spot things like facial expression modification well, and they don't spot it in low-res imagery, which, guess what? Low-res compressed imagery is what we deal with. So, next thing, cross-disciplinary solutions that build on existing practice. And this is where I'm looking to you guys. And guys, I'm using as a gender non-specific term, I should emphasize, as an English speaker. I'm looking to you guys here to think, how do we build on this expertise, right? And I think this has been a gap in the discussion of deepfakes, and it's often completely disconnected from the fact that fact-checkers, OSINT investigators, journalists, you've been grappling with this for a decade. So how do we do that? About 3 months ago, we brought together a whole range of key deepfakes researchers, people in the fact-checking, social news gathering world, to talk about what we knew about what we needed from each other. How could we prepare better? And I'm going to point you to the report. It's online. It's on Twitter, which looks at what do we have to do to address the gaps that exist now in order to be better prepared. And I'm going to point to a few of those things and encourage you to read the report. And I would love your engagement as a community in pushing this forward. The first thing we discovered was there is a gap in understanding of the problem already. So many of the academics are working with high-resolution imagery. It's a manual process. It's an artisanal process. We're working with high volume, high quantity, compressed images. We have a fast turnaround often, particularly in the journalism world. The tools are not matched. Second thing was the tools that exist in the academic world, we don't even know they exist. So the things that they know how to do around camera signature, around easy copy-paste detection, basic stuff, are not yet generalized in this community. There are, of course, people in this room who know how to do this. I know that. But they're not generalized to skills when this might be a problem at massive scale. Third thing is the tools are not available in the platforms, neither the tools for the existing problem, like reverse video search or provenance search, nor the future problem. And if we want to make them available, we need access to how the platforms can identify them as well. So these were key lessons learned. And that community is looking for collaboration. The deepfakes research community, they want to know how to develop the tools that matter. So I put this out as an invite to this room. How do we build that collaboration so you are better prepared? We have much more stronger structures on the detection side that come out of this community and your experience. Detection. There are three basic ways people are looking at detection right now. One is to do it with advanced ways of doing forensic detection. Can you see the copy and the paste? Can you see the manipulation of camera signatures or the distinctive signature of a GAN-generated, an AI-generated video? The second is to look at using the same approaches that we use for creation, for detection. So you build a process which basically learns to detect forgeries and then tells you that it's detected a forgery, but it's using the same iterative process you use to build the forgeries. And then the third is looking at where images come from. What is their provenance? What is the source material or the elements that were used to build the deepfake? And I think that's actually the one that might be most relevant here because it relates to our existing problem. The existing problem in the shallow fakes world of miscontextualized videos, videos we're trying to track down. So I think there's real crossover there that we should be building on. But all of these techniques are imperfect, but people are working on them. Oh, can't we just use blockchain? So every time someone posts on this, you get a version of this tweet back at you. Sometimes it's less polite. It's like, duh, guy, use blockchain. It's often in caps. And my response to that, if I can be polite, is no. I want a more nuanced discussion about how we think about how images are actually created and move in the world. So we've been doing a lot of research at Witness around this. My colleague Gabby Ivins has a report coming out that is looking at the pros and cons of what are called verified at capture apps. So these are tools that give you additional signals of where something was created, the metadata within it, potentially how it's been tampered with. And there's some examples of the companies involved in this space. For full transparency, Witness works on an open source tool called Proof Mode with the Guardian project, but there are a number of commercial projects there. And all of them are trying to say, we can give you much greater trust in images because you'll be able to see who signed them, when they were created, and if they've been tampered with. And this is really important. I think it's going to be a powerful signal for people to use. But the thing we've been saying about it is we've got to be really careful. Because if that got structured into our broader information environment, it would start to put a technical signal and prioritize that over the type of human reasoning we want around images. It's not actually, can we just find an image and see if it was created at a certain moment? We want to understand who can access those images, who can use those tools, right? Who might choose not to add lots of rich metadata and sign it to themselves in a country where the authoritarian government is cracking down, or you worry about data surveillance. So let's be careful about the checkmark. And then finally, platform and toolmaker responsibility. We need to decide, and I mean this as a community that includes this room, but many other people, what we want from platforms. What do we want them to signal? What do we want them to moderate? What they want them to tell a community of people who are experts and consumers about what they see, because some of this will be invisible to the eye, and we can't just say, hey guys, work it out. It will not be possible. So we need to decide what we want from that. And I would argue that we need to center in that, yes, this community, but also global communities who've been most adversely affected by the choices that the platforms have made about how to do this in the past. So this can't be a conversation. I look around this room and we're largely US and European, largely. This has to be a conversation that includes people in Myanmar, in Kenya, in the Middle East, in Brazil, who are gonna say, wait a second, this is gonna create harms as well as solve an existing problem. So we need to center that. Let me put one concrete thing that I think we could ask of platforms and tool makers in this space, like Adobe, on the table, which is they should make detection as accessible as creation. And so my critique, for example, of Adobe releasing the content-aware fill for video is, of course, it's forensically detectable. You can run that through a scan with a high-res version, and you're like, wow, someone's pulled out an object from that video. They've pulled out a police officer. But most of us, and 99% of people outside this room, have no idea to do that, and they're not providing an easy tool to do that part of it. So I'm going to say there is a responsibility right now in our information ecosystem for companies who build tools for creation to make it as easy as possible for consumers to see the manipulation if they want to look for it as it was to create it. So let me stop there. I want to push you again to this report and encourage you to feedback, to join our community that's trying to work on this, and I'd love to go to questions.
Now, as per usual, we have mic runners. If you have a question, please raise your hand. I will start also as per usual, then we'll go right here. To what extent does focusing on the next thing in disinformation keep us from fixing the current thing? Mm-hmm.
So this is a great question. I think we need to do both, and I also think they overlap. So, and I view it very much through the practice of my own organization, where we are as equally concerned with the current problem as the future one. The reasons to deal with the future one is, I think the whole range of actors around the future one haven't dealt well with the previous one, and we can do better. So the platforms can do better if we push them. We can have a more inclusive discussion of what we want. So those are key elements. There's also overlap. So like reverse video search, provenance analysis, you know, people are like, that's a problem now. So we can solve for both problems at the same time. And I always find it a little bit binary when people say either or. I'm like, surely we want to prepare to avert harm. Now, how any given individual allocates resources there or organization is totally appropriate. So within Witness, there's two of us really deeply focused on it and 33 people who are like, I'm going to input on that, but I'm dealing with now.
Wonderful. There's a question right here.
The last point you made about responsibility that platforms should share, I thank you for saying that, because that's a very, very important point. Because what we see is platforms moving on to new ventures and leaving the mess behind to deal, like we deal with that mess. But when you say responsibility, can you specify like how and what sort of responsibility platforms can take and how organizations, governments, can basically force them to do that?
Yeah.
Second point, that a question I wanted to ask, as you said, and it's very obvious, there are a lot of people from here who are from the West. So me being the only one, or maybe one of the few from the East side, we have a problem that the digital literacy or fluency, however you want to term it, is so bad that it takes a lot of time to basically sort that out. How can we take this knowledge, localize it into areas like Myanmar, or Kashmir, or Balochistan, and basically make it relevant?
Yeah, so I think that the question with the platforms about what they could do, I think there are ways to push them to do that, and there are ways to regulate them or legislate they do it. In the category of deepfakes, I think there's sort of an escalating scale that, you know, could relate to other forms of manipulated media or miscontextualized media. How do you signal to people that you've seen a manipulation, right? We know this has happened, we're gonna tell you, we're gonna give additional context. How do you give additional information that it could include, for example, a source video, a video that shows this is the original, right? So the equivalent of reverse video search. The second area might be how they moderate them. I'm not looking for a shared moderation policy, though, on synthetic media. I think it covers too many things, but we might say we really want to moderate that. That might vary by where we are. I would hope it's based on human rights standards, but I think that's a complicated discussion. The third thing we might ask is to ask them not to make the mistakes of the past. So a lot of our work is also around AI and content moderation and the takedowns of war crimes videos. I don't want an AI-based solution here that makes arbitrary decisions on what is synthetic or not and would sweep up satire, creative content, a whole bunch of things that are really important. Now, any of those options could be pushed by a community, they could be pushed by public pressure, they could potentially be legislated in. And I think that's an open discussion to have. And we need a discussion about what we want and what matters. There are particular characteristics to synthetic media that might also push us to ask for things like coordination on sharing training data so that you have a better way of spotting forgeries across a whole ecosystem, so cross-platform coordination. On the question of how to communicate this, I honestly want to turn it back to you and say, I think we need to make sure that's central to the conversation. Like, how do you talk about invisible to the eye manipulation to people when they already have relatively limited audiovisual literacy? But honestly, that's a problem everywhere, right? We know that CGI occurs in Hollywood. We do not have much research on how to talk to people about invisible to the eye manipulation of audio and video in a social media, in a friends and family environment. And I think that research will also be relevant. But then it needs to be locally specific to platforms, right? So this can't be a Facebook conversation if it doesn't include WhatsApp, right? And how we have tools in that. So I think it's a tools question, I think it's a literacy question, but I actually think there's some commonalities. But I would love to talk more about it and make sure that we're, yeah.
And we have time for one more question right here.
Hi, Linda from Redefine, a London-based think tank. We worked a lot with blockchain, and I share your outrage about these responses as soon as you say something negative.
Yeah.
They're against you, and there they come. But my concern is predominantly the fact that not enough people work on blockchain,
mm-hmm.
not enough people know about it, neither about the implications. And if you look at DTube, so the alternative to YouTube, there's an alternative to everything on blockchain, right? My main concern is, and I would like to hear your opinion, what are the future dangers and how we can counter them? Because if this is on a distributed ledger and it is predominantly there, decentralized, there forever, and DTube works on sharers and the users upvote or downvote a video. So if you've got a deepfake on the blockchain, it's there forever. Right. And if people love it, it's just getting upvoted as like this amazing video. Thank you.
Yeah, so I want to be careful. Like, I understand there is a role for blockchain in the solution. In fact, many of the verified at Capture use blockchain, use distributed ledger as an element. What I was objecting to there is actually very simplistic solutions that get tossed out in a, like, you're stupid and you haven't thought about this, and they're not reflective of actually a complex conversation. So it's a little bit that response of those kind. That wasn't a real tweet, but it reflects the nature. So I think there's a whole of society response here, of which blockchain is a tiny part of a technical solution versus the solution. So maybe that's sort of just to contextualize that. But I think you're pointing to one of the key problems is permanence is actually not always a good thing, right? Permanence of media, permanence of representation is challenging. It's one of the things we point to in this report that's coming out is, actually, if you look at kind of people's concerns about information, and we know that people take information offline. Now, of course, companies take it down, but other people make choices to take it down because your security, your privacy varies. So that's one argument there. I think the question of how we have a distributed record of things and how you use that alongside others, absolutely there's a place for it, but it needs to be a conversation that's informed by, like, what are the realities of the highest risk users in this, and how would this backfire, particularly if it starts to get built in across the infrastructure in a way they don't have a choice to participate in or not, and that's important.
Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now for the most interestingly named session of this entire event, I'd like to bring back Andy and Ben to the stage.